This is Friday. It's the 29th of January, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Ira Melman. I'm in Washington. Coming your way, Republican presidential candidates debate without the frontrunner. We'll track a family of Syrian refugees as they try to make a new life in a Midwestern U.S. city. And many of the most prestigious U.S. colleges and universities want to change the way they admit new students.
It's not long brag sheets. It's not how many AP courses you take or how many extracurricular activities you rack up. It's being intellectually, having intellectual vitality and passion and engagement. And it's having ethical engagement. It's being about concerned about others and contributing to your communities.
That's all ahead on International Edition. Republican presidential candidates held their last debates before Monday's Iowa caucuses. The frontrunner, Donald Trump, sat out this debate. He had a dispute with a host at the Fox News network, choosing instead to hold a fundraiser of his own for veterans just about 3 miles away from the debate venue. But his persona still loomed large. The moderator even nudged the candidates to acknowledge Trump's absence. Senator Ted Cruz appeared to mock Trump.
I'm a maniac. And everyone on this stage is stupid, fat, and ugly. And Ben, you're a terrible surgeon. Now that we've gotten the Donald Trump portion out of the way.
Each candidate was trying to break past Trump, still are doing that, who still leads in most public opinion polls heading into next Monday's caucus. Joining us from Iowa is VOA's Kane Faribault. Kane, I understand you've been following the Democrats, but what are you hearing around the state of Iowa about last night's debate and the absence of Trump?
Well, I think, as you mentioned, you know, even though he wasn't on the debate stage, Donald Trump's presence loomed large over the entire gathering. And even though he wasn't on the stage, he was somebody that they had to address because, as you mentioned, the moderators kept bringing it up. But also, too, you know, the candidates themselves, in response to some of those nudges by the moderators, you know, addressed some of the things that Trump has said on the campaign trail. They've also addressed why he wasn't there. And I think that it was really a moment for these other candidates to seize that stage because Trump wasn't there. And in some ways, I think some of them fell short of that goal because they kept addressing the man who wasn't even in the room.
Do you think that Trump, in his mind, feels that he made, well, of course, in his mind, he feels he made the right move. But what is the overall feeling that you are getting traveling around the state as you have about whether he made the right move in deciding not to show up at the debate?
You know, people who are fervently supporting Donald Trump are going to be voting for him on Monday, regardless of whether or not he appeared at the debate on that debate stage. The people that are following him, the people that are supporting him in this state, already have made up their minds as to who they're going to vote for when they caucus or when they gather to vote for their favorite candidate on February 1st. But the larger question is, what did this do for those people who are still undecided and uncommitted who might have been watching the debate? Clearly, Donald Trump wasn't there on the stage to say things which could alienate him from voters. So in a way, that's probably good. Because those people may still be undecided about Donald Trump. But then again, too, those people who are still trying to figure out who they should vote for probably wanted to hear from him on that debate stage in a venue which he didn't control, in an arena in which he would be forced to answer questions. And so I think that some of those people that are undecided probably still have a lot of those questions, and they weren't answered because Trump wasn't on the stage.
Now, we shall see, obviously, on Monday how it worked out for Trump, and Trump is gaining the headlines. Trump apparently knows how to manipulate the media, and there has been news on the Democratic side, especially about Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders. That's what you've been focusing on. What's the latest there?
Well, really, you know, for a lot of people who might be turned off by the message of the Republicans on the campaign trail here. There's a lot of people who are concerned about the rising level of rhetoric and the level of attention some of that rhetoric has received. And so those are people who are probably going to be voting for the Democrats. And really, it's a two-way race for the Democrats. It's a choice between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders, even though Martin O'Malley is in the race. He isn't polling very high. So it's the goal of these two candidates to reach Democratic voters or supporters who are going to caucus for the Democrats to sort of define who they are and compare and contrast the differences between the two candidates. And I think it's a delicate balance on the campaign trail because both of these candidates are trying to create a very wide dividing line between the two of them, between Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton, yet both of them are also trying to prevent nasty campaign attacks, nasty advertising. And so each of them is trying to carefully chart out their territory, explaining how they are different from the other candidate, while also highlighting the things that they both can agree on. And I think what Hillary Clinton is trying to do is she's trying to appeal to voters by having them understand that a lot of the things that Bernie Sanders is promising, which is free tuition to college for everyone, universal health care coverage, a lot of these things are lofty goals which can't realistically be achieved in the political environment in Washington. And while Bernie Sanders might be saying those things in the campaign trail, she's realistic about the reality of those things not coming to fruition. And so she's trying to carve out a different plan in which she would try to provide some of these benefits, some of these programs to people, but in a realistic political environment that needs to be operated in within Washington.
Well, again, we shall see on Monday. You will be there along with the other members of our VOA news staff. Kane Farabaugh, VOA, reporting from Iowa. Thanks, Kane. We appreciate it.
Thanks,
Ira. And joining us now, as he does every week, is our social media guru, Andrew Palaszewski. And how much did that debate last night show up as far as social media is concerned?
Oh, lots. I mean, on the one hand, you had the debate itself, which was very buzzworthy. You had a lot of moments, Ted Cruz coming out and saying, you know, insulting the candidates kind of facetiously and then saying, now that we've gotten the Trump part out of the way. But really, Donald Trump was the big kind of, you know, person who wasn't in the room, literally wasn't in the room, but everybody was kind of piling on him. And on social media, people saying that Trump actually won the debate, even though he wasn't there, because he was still the topic of the debate. Even though he didn't show up, he didn't have to take any of the attacks. And what was he doing instead? He was off raising millions of dollars for veterans with, by the way, Rick Santorum and Mike Huckabee on stage with him, the two previous winners of the Iowa caucus.
Which was so strange. If you watched it, as I did at least part of it on television. By the way, the ratings are coming in, the TV ratings, that apparently Trump had more viewers for his thing that he held in Iowa than the whole Republican debate.
I'm not surprised. I mean, social media, if that's any indication, Trump, just the conversation follows him wherever he goes. And people are so fascinated by him on social media, always talking about him. And so a lot of people saying this was a great move for him on social media, saying that he didn't have to face any of these attacks. Ted Cruz got attacked. He's the one running behind Donald Trump. He was the one who got attacked. People talking about his moments on Twitter, not in a positive way, and positively talking about Trump.
People around the world who are not in the United States, well, a lot of people in the United States as well, are wondering what is the attraction of Donald Trump. Does that come up in social media as well?
Oh, absolutely. And a big part of it is the celebrity factor. He tells it like it is. It's why a lot of his supporters like him. But he has this whole base already, is, you know, from his time as a real estate mogul, his time as host of the show The Apprentice. I remember back when I was a kid, one of my favorite movies, one of my favorite movies still is, Home Alone, Lost in New York.
When he's a kid, he said. Okay.
But Home Alone 2, Lost in New York, Donald Trump makes a cameo appearance in that movie, and that was in early 1990s. So he's been a celebrity for decades, and so he has this following that's kind of built in as a celebrity figure, and I think a lot of people have followed him because of that.
What else is trending?
Well, the Australian Open is taking place this weekend. Actually, it's been taking place for the past 2 weeks. But the finals are this weekend for the men's and women's singles. On the women's side, you have Serena Williams playing Angelique Kerber of Germany. Angelique Kerber has never been to a Grand Slam final before. This is her first one.
Good luck, Angelique.
Serena has been to 26. This will be her 26th, and she's won 21 of them. So looking like she might add to that record be 22, which she would actually tie Steffi Graf, a German. For the record, most Grand Slam wins for a man or woman. On the men's side, you have Novak Djokovic playing Andy Murray, the number one and number two players in the world. And this is actually a rematch of last year's Australian Open final, which Djokovic won. So a lot of people talking about that. Here in the U.S., people have to wake up very early. I think the matches start at 3:30 in the morning.
Yeah.
Here in the U.S. So.
Well, that's when you and I get up. That's when we get out of bed, so we see some of it if we'd like to.
Yeah. Those are the big stories, and whatever else the weekend will hold, we'll see. And surely, as Iowa gets closer, it's coming up on Monday, there's going to be a lot of buzz about that. And all through Monday night, as people are out caucusing, we're going to see a lot of social media reaction. And I'm actually curious to see if we see any video coming out from the caucuses. We had Twitter and Facebook the last go-round, but not really a lot of the video that we have now. Since then, Twitter has incorporated streaming video. Facebook's incorporated streaming video. So I wouldn't be surprised if you saw some people actually streaming the process and giving us an inside look on social media as to how the caucus takes place.
The one, the only, Andrew Palcheski, our social media guru here on International Edition. Thanks, Andrew.
Thank you.
This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Globular star clusters are spherical, tightly bound groupings of hundreds of thousands of stars that usually can be found within a galaxy's periphery. Scientists say that there are several hundreds of these star clusters in our own Milky Way galaxy. Stars in these clusters have long been thought to be some of the oldest in the universe after being formed all at once and around the same time. But now an international team of astronomers may have cast some doubt on this thinking, since they discovered populations of young stars in these groupings. Rather than all of its stars being formed around the same time, the researchers found that the presence of younger stars indicates that there may be several generations of stars that make up the clusters. The astronomers also say they've found evidence that these young stars have developed from gas that flows from outside the cluster instead of internal material cast off by other stars. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
More than half of Syria's population, that's 11 million people, have either been killed or have left the country since the uprising and the civil war began nearly 5 years ago. But most refugees' quest for safety has only begun when they leave Syria. Erica Celeste reports now from Indianapolis, Indiana, on the journey of the first Syrian family to find a new home in that Midwestern city.
Looks like a typical American family scene. A 13-year-old boy and his 11-year-old sister sit on a couch, heads bent close together over a smartphone. Their younger brothers play on the floor with an assortment of action figures. However, they are anything but typical. In 2011, they and their parents escaped the civil war in Syria with only the clothes on their backs.
In the beginning, the war wasn't near our city, but it kept moving from city to city and getting closer to us. We felt we couldn't take it anymore. That's when we realized we needed to travel.
Wyatt Alamud's husband, Fadi Lababidi, owned a small business, which allowed him to travel to Jordan and find a temporary safe haven for his family. But in the month he was gone, border security tightened so much that it took four attempts and finally a bribe to get them out. Once in Jordan, they saw their home, business, and nearly everything in their city bombed and turned to rubble. The family realized they would never go home again. As life for the thousands of Syrians fleeing into Jordan became more difficult, Lababidi applied to the UN for refugee status.
My concern was to take my family anyplace good.
The family spent the next 3 years in limbo, not knowing what country they might go to or even what language they should learn. During their last year in Jordan, the adults underwent a series of six interviews, each lasting 5 hours. Then the call came. Exodus Refugee Immigration would help them move to Indianapolis, Indiana. They had just 6 days to prepare and knew little English. Sarah Hindi, an intern with the social service group, met them at the Indianapolis airport to act as their interpreter and became the family's mentor.
I kind of took on the opportunity to be there for them, to be a friend for them, to be a family member for them that was here before, that grew up in the United States, that knew what life was like being an Arab and Muslim in the United States.
The kids quickly picked up English, happy to be back in school. Lababidi got a job, and for the most part, the community was helpful and welcoming. Then came November's terror attacks in France. In response, governors of more than half the states, including Indiana, signed a petition to stop Syrian refugees from resettling in the United States. Lababidi says he understands the governor's fear and need to keep their people safe, but he wishes they wouldn't single out Syrians.
This is a problem in Syria, not just from people Syria. You know, not just from people Syria. No. From every people from every country. From Iran, from Iraq, from France, from America, from Europa, from Lebanon, from Jordan, from every people.
The family has made it their mission to counter the link between Syrian refugees and terrorism. They've extended an invitation to anyone to come to their home for a cup of Alamoud's deliciously rich Arabian coffee and to hear their story.
People who commit all these horrible acts in the name of Islam don't know Islam at all. Islam does not order killing. Those people don't represent Muslims at all.
Just in the name of Islam. But these people know Islam.
The family hopes someday even Indiana Governor Mike Pence will visit their home to see they are truly like any other American family. Kids on their smartphones, mom in the kitchen, dad working hard. They've just been through a little more to reach for the American dream. For VOA News, I'm Erica Celeste in Indianapolis, Indiana.
This is VOA.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
This is International Edition. My name's Ira Melman. There's a movement to change the admission processes at many well-regarded U.S. colleges and universities. The effort is to replace what are now measures of a student's ability to achieve high test scores and take advanced classes with a new emphasis on their concern for others, their dedication to their families, and various community interest. I spoke with one of the leaders of the movement. Richard Weisbord is a senior lecturer at the Harvard Graduate School of Education, as well as a co-director of a group there called Making Caring Common. And it is that group that issued the report called Turning the Tide, Inspiring Concern for Others and the Common Good Through College Admissions.
I think the college admissions process needs to send a powerful message. And this is the first time in history that this large group of colleges have done this collectively. Send a powerful message that ethical engagement and intellectual engagement are what's important. It's not long brag sheets. It's not how many AP courses you take or how many extracurricular activities you rack up. It's being intellectually, having intellectual vitality and passion and engagement. And it's having ethical engagement. It's being about concerned about others and contributing to your communities.
How do you gauge that?
In terms of concern for others, concern for your communities, we are recommending a couple things. One is that we define contribution differently so that low-income working-class kids who are working to support their families or supervising a younger sibling or taking care of a sick relative, that should count a lot in college admissions and should count a lot more than a brief stint of service in Belize. So one of the things is that we're encouraging students to report those kind of contributions. We are also, arguing for changes in recommendation forms. We're asking that for students to try and get recommendations from people they have worked with in providing a service or who have been recipients of service. And I will tell you that, college admissions officers can usually tell. I mean, I think they're very thoughtful, by and large, and they can tell something that's inauthentic from something that's authentic. So we want kids to be able to describe their experiences in ways that are meaningful, and I think usually college admissions officers can tell what a meaningful experience is or if experience has been meaningful to a student.
How much support is there for this type of revamping and change, and from what kind of schools so people can actually relate to what we're talking about?
So we have about 90 endorsers now. 60 of those endorsers are college admissions deans or college administrators. All the Ivy League admissions deans have endorsed, but also a wide range of colleges have endorsed. Small liberal arts colleges like Kenyon, big state schools like the University of Washington and the University of Michigan. We do have a wide range of endorsements here from a broad range of colleges.
What might this do to college ratings? A lot of people put a lot of interest into how colleges are rated and where they want to send their kids.
What we are trying to get to here is rating colleges in a different way. And in part. And, it really should be, colleges shouldn't be rated in terms of the number of students that they rejected in the college application process. That doesn't seem like the right way to rate a college. Colleges should be rated in terms of the quality of their intellectual life, in terms of the quality of their ethical life.
And what comes to my mind are parents in China, parents in Asia, parents in India, parents in Africa, who are raising their children in a certain way to be able to compete in this test intensive admission process.
There is a parent issue here that, at some point, there are a lot of unhealthy kids. We have high rates of stress and depression because of all this achievement pressure in affluent communities. And parents, I think, really do have a role in dialing some of that down and in recognizing that there are hundreds of good colleges around in this country, excellent colleges, and everybody's just focused on a handful. And that's a real problem in terms of levels of stress and depression for kids and their families.
What do you think is the possibility or maybe even probability of this leading to some significant changes?
Well, I think it already has. My hope is it already has led to some significant changes, that there are going to be a lot of students around the country, around the world, who are not going to be so stressed about racking up AP courses and extracurricular activities. They're not going to be so focused on that. And that they are going to find ways in some sustained way for, 9 months, a year, to get involved in their communities and do something that's going to be a powerful learning experience for them. So I hope some of those changes are already, sparked by this report.
That's our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Ira Melman. Enjoy a weekend.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States is concerned about the growing number of people in China recently, also including European citizens, who appear to have been coerced to confess to alleged crimes on state media, often before any trial or the announcement of any charges. Some of these people have not been afforded timely legal or consular representation, and there are also instances in which foreign nationals appear to have been brought to mainland China against their will and by extra legal means. Recent detainees who appeared on China Central Television, or CCTV, in pre-recorded confession videos include Hong Kong-based publisher Ge Minhai of Mighty Current Media and Causeway Bay Books. Ge, a Swedish national, emerged on CCTV this month after disappearing from Thailand. Just 3 days after Ge's appearance on TV, another Swedish national, China-based human rights worker Peter Dahlin, appeared on CCTV apologizing for allegedly hurting the feelings of the Chinese people. Mr. Dahlin founded the Chinese Urgent Action Working Group to help train human rights lawyers and other activists and was accused by the Chinese state news agency Xinhua of encouraging the masses to oppose the government. Reporters Without Borders Asia-Pacific spokesman Benjamin Ismail said his organization was outraged by the dissemination of forced confessions that have no informational value. Xinhua and CCTV, he added, represent a threat to freely produced news in the public interest. In the Reporters Without Borders Press Freedom Index, China ranks 176th out of 180 countries. Veteran Chinese journalist Gao Yu, who also appeared in a so-called confession on CCTV before being jailed for allegedly leaking state secrets overseas, later said her confession was coerced after Chinese authorities threatened her son. In 2015, she was sentenced to 7 years in prison, which was later reduced to 5 years on appeal. Due to medical reasons, she is currently serving her sentence outside of prison. Others who have been paraded before the cameras with forced confessions include Sheng Nanfu, Shen Yang Zadu, and Charles Shui. These actions, said State Department Deputy Spokesperson Mark Toner, undermine China's claim to be a rule-of-law society and run contrary to China's human rights commitments, and hinder its attempts to build a more transparent and effective justice system.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.